And the heels of Rabbi Laura Jonathan Sacks' directives about what it means to be a parent that feels both the obligation but also the empowerment and the opportunity and the bracha of moving our children through some of the challenging moments of what it means to be an adolescent, what it means to be an adult that feels responsible for the future of our people. I find myself very moved and very inspired. And actually it brings me back and reminds me very much of my own childhood and my own commitments as someone in Chinuch for what do we do with these very predictable and changing stages that our teenagers go through. Predictable in the sense that this is the very definition of adolescence. It is actually the differentiation stages that developmentally they must go through. And if they didn't question and ask and challenge and look for boundaries and borders, they wouldn't be doing the right thing. And so every teenager will do that. Every one of us had some of those experiences, perhaps with different shapes and different contours and with different content. And so it is one of the most predictable challenges that every generation has. And still, as the generational context changes, as all of the nature of the culture around us changes, we find ourselves wondering if we're the first. And how can it be? And what will it be like? And so I think in a very significant way, the task we have before us today, and in some ways it reminds me very much of what I just heard from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, is one of reassuring and reestablishing our own commitments and our own sense of confidence that this is all right. I know growing up, I did, in fact, as many others probably in this room and others feel, that my questions were not answered. I did, in fact, feel very strongly that there was no room for questioning. Instead of being able to simply model the encouragement or the answers or the invitation to discuss by the adults around me, I simply had to go find that someplace else. And biographically, those of you who know me know that led me to leave my adolescent community. I grew up in Lubavitch, I grew up in Crown Heights, and I don't espouse to be a part of the community any longer. Finding a space where that conversation was able to be had in a healthy, encouraging, and positive manner was really important. And it wasn't about not believing in God. It was about being able to have any deep, thoughtful conversation that responded to where I was. And I think that, you know, without everyone having to replicate each other's experiences, because by virtue of what it means to be a human being and different parts of our community, that's not going to happen. But recognizing what it means to be an adolescent who needs to ask questions and who needs to have a conversation and be invited into that conversation by the parents that they trust, by the community that they are looking to be a part of, is, I think, that reminder that we received this morning. Without having seen those comments, I've prepared my own shiur based on an appreciation that has emerged biographically for myself and also educationally. This commitment to making space for questioning, for thoughtful conversations, and for recognizing that's an inherent part of our communal commitments, of our emunah, of our very own emunah. Why would we expect teenagers, and why would we expect ourselves to redesign something that's not authentic? Essentially as a part of our own learning, we highlight, we promote, we value analytics and questions. And yet when it comes to a space where we think it's coming out of potential denial, rejection, rebellion, all of a sudden we get super sensitive. We don't have anything to say. The assumptions we act upon is, if my teen is questioning, then it means they don't believe in Hashem. Utterly false. If I validate their doubts, then it means I'm pushing them away from halacha. Utterly false. If I was a good parent, then they wouldn't even question. Where do these come from? they come up in our heads so naturally, and yet they push us away from addressing the legitimacy of what is a normal stage of development in our own lives and in our kids' own lives. So with that background, really what I want to do today is help us as parents and as individuals and as mechanchim reassure our commitment to the space for doubt within what it means to be a faithful human being. Being a faithful, committed, halachic Jew does not mean we don't have questions. It does not mean there is no place for doubt. In fact, if we wanted to spend a lot of time, there's whole fields of Jewish philosophy, medieval, modern, that is committed to showing us that that actually is the reverse. It's the absolute opposite. As you doubt, you are affirming your faith. You don't doubt something that you don't care about. You might deny it, but that's a different thing. Okay? And teenagers aren't typically denying. They're asking questions. And therefore, if we could spend some time validating how it is, in fact, a part of being a faithful human being, a person committed to faith, that we allow for the space for doubt and questions and understanding it a little bit more, recognizing that having emunah has multiple layers. It's far more flexible. It's not binary. It doesn't just exist or doesn't exist. Will offer us the opportunity with greater confidence to find and build those spaces to have the conversations, not the answers, with our students and our children. And one very quick caveat that I said to my students just very recently, and it simply came out in a casual conversation. If you have a good question, love that question. Love it. It's yours. Don't try to look for an answer to put it away. That's the question that's going to carry you through 1,000 conversations. Each part of that conversation is going to give you something more to think about. Don't ever try to retire your questions. Those are yours. Treasure them. That's what leads you to have even more interesting conversations with the next person you're going to meet. So think about it as a parent and as a mechanech. It's not your obligation to answer the question so that it's solved. It's your obligation to talk about that question so that you're now in the conversation as opposed to with the burden of running away from it, which sends a lot of other messages, or the burden of answering it, which why do we even think we need to? And that's a very different layer of the experience. So let's look at the Torah views and ideas that are inherent in this dilemma about doubt and how we can not just psychologically and emotionally embrace the experience of questions and doubt, but also from a Torah traditional perspective recognize that's an inherently important part of our emunah. Okay, first I brought you a selection from Avot. Avot is one of those amazing masechtot that people highly, I think, dismiss in its value in the sense that it's so quick and it's so easy and it's so familiar, and so we don't think of it as these deep principles. We just think of it as these quick principles. Whenever I learn Avot, I always try to take the perspective of think about this as an ethical will. It's not Amar Rabbi Akiva. He just happened to say it as he was walking down the street. This is his ethical will. He wants people to think about him in the following way, in a really succinct, hashtaggy way. This is what I stand for. Okay, so if you look at it that way, then you see the depth of what these little phrases might mean and could mean, depending on if you know the context and you apply them in a different way. So there's this interesting concept that comes out of Hillel, and it's multiple layers, as we would expect. Al tifrosh min atzibur v'al tamim b'atzmacha ad yom modcha v'al tadun et chavercha ad shetegia limimkomo v'al tomar dvar shi efshar l'shmo v'sofa l'hashmiya v'al tomar v'chesha efne eshne shema lo tifne. So there's multiple messages here, and it's really a lot of fun to try to build one thread. The beginning portion of this Mishnah is all about community, but it's about a community and a shared experience and human nature that we should all be able to relate to, not necessarily in one moment of life, right? Al tifrosh min atzibur here reflects the fact that don't think of yourself as such an iconoclast. not the idea that we all have to dress exactly the same. This is Al Tifrosh Min HaTzibur, don't think of yourself as not falling sway to the basic human habits. Don't think of yourself as such a Yotzei Min HaKlal. And in that light, also, don't think that you got it covered. Al Tamim Ba'atzvahad Yom Yom Motcha. And the different interpretations of this portion of the Mishnah reflect the story of the Kohen Gadol, who turned into tzaduki late in his life, right? Ad yom motcha. There is this essential characteristic of doubt and questioning that still persists alongside all of your service, alongside all of your faith, alongside entire life that you built. How is it that Kohen Gadol changes his actual emunah at the very end of his life? This is an essential quality of being faithful. Doubt is an essential quality of being faithful. I find that, frankly, quite liberating. I know for myself, as I already referenced my own biographical experiences, my own personal experiences, when I sat down to read the Rav's Lonely Man of Faith, first I was devastated, and then I was entirely liberated. That the Rav would express a loneliness, that the Rav, who I'm like learning Torah from, dripping, you know, from one word of his essay, would say to me that he was still alone, was devastating. I literally put the book away. I couldn't fathom what that meant until I appreciated that what he was saying to me was, that's what it means to live a life in which you're trying to aspire towards connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're always going to have a certain degree of loneliness. And the Rav described it like in totality, because his emunah was in totality. I'm never going to be there, so I don't have to be as afraid of the Rav's loneliness, because that's not going to be my loneliness. But to experience some loneliness and to recognize that that's an inherent part of being a ma'amin was actually so liberating. I didn't need to solve every question. If the Rav was lonely, I was allowed to be lonely. I was allowed to sit around and learn and still not have the whole answer resolved. That was an incredible insight. I could be a philosophy major and have tons of questions and not have it all resolved. That's unbelievable that the Rav could stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning and cry because he didn't really understand what Hashem was ruling to him at that moment. It was amazing. I really felt invited into a community of ma'aminim because of my lack of the ability to answer. So I think that's something that's really powerfully important, I think, as parents and as mechanchim, not to be so scared when we see our kids sort of like feeling uncomfortable or asking questions. It's like an exciting invitation. You want to talk to me about davening? I could be terrified because I don't have a lot to say, right? But you want to talk to me about davening? That's great. You're having a hard time with it, guess what? So do I, right? Let me show you something that I read once that was okay. Let me make sure we continue this conversation. It's a very different reality than saying, how could you not get up? I always did. It's got to be, you know, which is not really true, so. In addition to a classical place for doubt in our emunah, of course we know that we live in a very different world, where the context is continuously raising doubts, right? And raising an expectation of show it to me, prove it to me, tell me how it is, Siri can answer it, why can't you, right? This like instantaneous expectation makes it far harder and much, and again raises the burden of what we consider proof on our shoulders to be that much more difficult. And I think what we need to help create is a little more sophisticated, a little more countercultural, as the age seems to be progressing in this direction of show me, give me now and not later. But that's also not new. Being countercultural goes back to the very basics of being able to stand your ground and not do exactly what everybody else does. That's got to be our bread and butter. That's got to be what we stand for. And in a stage of rationalism or super rationalism, which has led to not just skepticism, but postmodernism, where nothing is true, and that actually is the language. It's not, please tell me how I know it is true. you can't even define truth, because what's true to you or what's true to them, it's this relativism, which is an extreme version and justification of just a personal self-service. Listen, that's true for you. It's not true for me. It doesn't work for me. That's the cultural that we're in. We're not even in a rationalist stage. We're in a postmodern stage, which is truths are all relative, and skepticism is the only currency that seems to have a lot of weight. And so I push myself back to a stage which is both philosophical, psychological, and I also think especially true for teenagers. It's a little bit more of existentialism. Valuing, it's true that mine and your existence and experiences are different. It's in that space that you can become stronger in your emunah. It's not rejecting your personal experience. It's recognizing, talking through, understanding. Existentialism is valuing the existence of each individual without making them the arbiter of everything that's true. Right? So again, it's not binary. You don't have to reject an individual's perspective and experience or totally accept it as the only measure of what could be possibly be true. But you still give it space in the conversation. And yes, it is true that it's kind of confusing to know what's right and wrong. Right? That's another methodology that's really relevant to this age where people are looking for the validation of their own experience. And existentialism as emunah, as we develop emunah, has a legitimate place. It has its space in our relationships. It has its space in our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. So give me a moment, a little philosophy. I want to use the language of Martin Buber, who was directly responding to the claims that rationalists put out there as proof is the only measure of how it is that you can be a believer. And Martin Buber answered, no, experience also teaches us how to be a believer. Your experience, your existential experiences are different from mine, and yet we share the realities of trying to encounter and relate to our world and to ourselves and to others. He utilizes the language of three forms of faith. And again, this is for me to share with you how emunah itself leaves space for variations and for doubt. Okay? And so that's why I'm spending the time to develop Martin Buber's ideas of emunah, because even there we see that we can all espouse, aspire, and encourage our kids to be ma'amin even through the stages of doubt. Okay? So he offers us three stages. One is an I-it relationship, which is super cognitive and intellectual. I relate to it. I want to know it. It is separate from me. It is different. It is material. I can know this bottle. I can learn about it. I can measure it. I can weigh it. I can learn more about it. I can learn less about it. I can have opinions about it. It's it. I have no personal relationship to it as much as it infiltrates my psyche, my understanding of the world. It's a very separate individual cognitive relationship. It's based on the principle of if I know it well, then the more I know it, then the better connected I am to it, but it's still really separate from me. It's knowledge-based. And sure, we know that Talmud Torah tells us to know a lot. We spend a lot of time studying information-wise, and still this is perceived to be sort of a very minimal, basic beginning stage of emunah, for some very good reasons. Because in so much as we try to just collect dates and data or facts about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're certainly going to be limited. And about our emunah, we're certainly going to be limited. Many people think about emunah in this way. And classically, the Rambam's concept of if you want to develop your Avad Hashem, the mitzvah of Avad Hashem for the Rambam is defined by learning more about Hashem. So it's very interesting. We'll just skip the Yirmiyahu for a minute. Look at the Rambam Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah when the Rambam writes out a formula for what it is that people should be learning and spending their time learning cognitively. What's the best way to build our knowledge and insight? What does the Rambam says? The Rambam says that in the middle of the source it gave you, first he's describing how there are all different layers of understanding Torah. It describes it as pardes, and not everybody is able. She'ein ro'i l'tayel v'pardes, ela mi shenitmalei kriso lechem abasar, not at Pardes is Pshat Remesh Drashen. So the Gemara refers to this being more of the mystical learnings of Torah, and certainly that's the context in which certain Tanaim were known to have gone astray. Rabbi Meir and Acher, to be specific. In any case, the Rambam says here that study is important, but first you have to be satisfied with lechem and basar. You have to satisfy and settle literally your belly with lechem and basar. V'lechem v'basar, what are they? Hu leida ha'isur v'hamutar chiyotze behem mishar ha'mitzvot. That's like your bread and your meat, right? Your heter and your isurim. Even though these are considered relative to the hierarchy of what's really important in our lives as ma'aminim, the practical what to do, what not to do is the foundational, you know, meat and potatoes. It's called davar katan. It's small. But there are meat and our potatoes, and the davar gadol is ma'aseh merkava, the mystical philosophical understanding and relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's davar gadol, but that's dessert. Your meat and potatoes come first because everyone has access to them. Everyone has the ability to understand them, and the davar gadol, the metaphysical material, is stuff that has to come later, even if it is that important. Okay, so you can't jump to dessert. So this reminds me of 20 years ago when I started my teaching career and I really wanted to teach Jewish philosophy. You already know why. That's where I was, right? I needed to ask the questions and I wanted to have the opportunity to have those questions in conversation with teenagers. And the arguments that I faced were, why are you introducing stuff to these kids? You know, they need their Chumash and Rashi. Why do they need to read the Rambam and the Ramban on miracles, on Malachim, on what? You can't go to dessert. Where's the meat and potatoes? So we started as a club. The kids are willing to put in their extra time, come after school, or instead of dance, or instead of something else, then they already got into it. They clearly still wanted it. That club became so large and became, you know, this was way back when in my note, and it's now a critical part of the course. And in all yeshiva high schools, Jewish philosophy and machshava is a critical part of the course, of your coursework. It's not dessert when the walls and the questions and the understanding of what's going on in the world is right there now on your phone, but right there in middle of your experience. We cannot pretend that these questions are being introduced to them when we start talking about it. In fact, one of my jobs as an educator is to shrink the distance as much as possible between the world that kids live in and the world the adults live in. And the more conversations that are happening in that middle space, because we know they're not exactly the same, the healthier it is for our children to know that they don't really live in a separate planet, and that we really do hear them and want to be a part of that conversation. So I think that's an interesting epistemological statement that the Rambam is making, that metaphysics and these big ideas is the great grand goal, and we have to get there. From a methodological perspective, I think it's really important for us to recognize that that's not always a sequence that we get to follow. We don't get to chronologically, you know, predict when those questions come up. What the Rambam is telling us is that it's a davar gadol. You better know that it's not just meat and potatoes that we're having the conversation about, because the other matters are really important. Now, the next two levels of relationships, of emuna, as described by Buber and other existentialists, and the Rav and Rabbi Lam explicitly really uses this model, are both relational. It's the functional I-he, and the next one is the I-thou, the affective. And here's where I believe it's really important for us to recognize that there is a space where the questions and conversations that are raised in the sense of I don't understand schar v'onesh, and I don't really know why I daven if I don't get the answers that I want. are different from this is what we do and this is what I'm aspiring towards. The intellectual pursuit of understanding ideas and understanding our ability to use those ideas to inspire our lives and to work on our own Avodas Hashem is the I-it relationship. It's cognitive, it's learning, it's conversations, it's ideas, it's curiosity, right? The I-thou and the I-he relationship are very different. I-he is saying I have a behavioral commitment. It's not that I believe that and I can tell you the rest of the sentence. I believe in, and I don't always know how to explain it. Okay, that's a different level of emunah. I believe that Hashem has everything just and that prayer works. Therefore, I daven for the sick kid and it worked. That's a very different expectation, right? That's a, I can lay it out for you cognitively, intellectually. I have all the proofs. And that's this like process that we want our children and we want ourselves to continuously learn about. We want to continuously try to get a better grasp. I need more language. I need a better story. I need a better metaphor. I need, right? That's my I-it. But it doesn't have to be that if I'm stuck here, my I-he and my I-thou relationship is totally thrown off, right? I believe in my friend. I believe in my parents. I believe in my spouse. Can I give you like a whole dissertation on why? No, but I'm still going to go to them, and I'm still going to pick you up, and I believe in you, even though you didn't do what you needed to do yesterday. We do this all the time. We live our lives functionally without pure proof. We don't have it all layered logically, right? So this whole concept that you have to be intellectually honest, and if you have a question, then how could you possibly daven? It's not the way anyone lives their lives, right? I believe in tefillah. I can't explain it to you, but I will continue to daven. I'll keep learning about tefillah as much as I can, but I won't always be able to explain it, and I believe in tefillah. And then the aspiration of, if I daven a lot, all I can tell you is, I don't think that's really ours. I'm still looking at my clock down here. If I daven a lot, I'm in the game. I can't possibly become a better baseball player if I don't go to practice. I can't possibly understand all the metaphors and everything that my coach is telling me. And if I watch every single game, I'm trying to study the game as much as I possibly can, I won't be a better player unless I actually go and do it. And I think we, the adults in the room, need to do that better with ourselves and need to do that better with our kids, with confidence to split that up. And say, yeah, talk to me about it. 100%. We're still going to go, you know, we're still going to wash our hands for Alantis today. So there's like, not to make them so connected. If you don't go to davening, then you don't believe in Hashem. Okay, you can have a hard time with your davening, and we're going to go. Tell me something that you're going to try this time or not. Maybe your avoda is simply getting up, right? And maybe your avoda is recognizing that at some future state, you're going to be able to understand it better and that you're going to connect to it better. So the I-he relationship is the functional relationship. It is more about having a firm commitment, a belief in something rather than a belief that something. And the pasuk that I brought here was coming from when Moshe Rabbeinu is davening, but his hands, Vayihi yadav emunah ad b'hashemesh. What the word emunah there means is that it was constant. It was consistent. It was firm. It's not that it made a lot of sense, specifically in these circumstances, right? B'nai Yisrael, we're not looking to Moshe. Please, Moshe, if your hands are up, we're going to win the war. If your hands are down, we're gonna lose. No, please, Moshe, remind us of the constancy of your commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That reminds us of our constancy. So emunah is about consistency also. There's emunah that's about understanding. There's a munah about consistency. Let's not underplay that. How important it is, I don't know who said it, like 99% of life is showing up. How important it is, right? Somebody else. How important it is to value it and to give it real credence in as an expression of emunah, as an expression of aspiration, as an expression of some future that we're all aiming towards. Similarly, in the Gemara describes what it takes to develop a settled personality. And here, this is Kiddushin. I'm sorry, it doesn't say so on the top of the second page. It says, Kol sheyeshno b'mikra b'mishna u'b'derech eretz. Lo b'mheira hu choteh. Everyone who holds, who's standing, we're solid in mikra, mishna, and derech eretz, such as Torah shebichtav, Torah shebaal peh, and the way we live our lives, and ethics, right? Torah shebichtav, obviously, is just our cognitive learning. Torah shebaal peh is functionally, how do we behave? What's our iser and heter? What are we supposed to do? You don't learn Mishnayos always to get an intellectual high. You actually have to learn it to know what to do. And then ethically, how do we apply this in an integrated way so that we are the kinds of people who model and aspire to being beacons of Emunei Hashem, people who people can look at and say, that's what it is. V'hachud ha-mishalash, someone who has all three of these things, lobim harian attack for chosha eno lobim mikra v'lobim mishna v'lobim derech eretz eno min hayishuv, meaning they're not settled. There's something a little bit off. You need all three components. You need to have a cognitive component. You need to have a functional component. And you also need to have this aspirational component. Your derech eretz is your aspiration to have a real relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the people, HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the experiences that you have. I think we have about 7 minutes. So, about 10 minutes, okay. So looking at the third stage of the I-Thou, this is really described as a fully integrated sensibility of experiencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, an encounter, a relationship. This is sometimes when people talk about Hashem being a beloved, there being a real sense not just of I know you, I trust you, but I also, I'll give up everything for you. Rabbi Akiva's example, right? And as Rabbi Akiva is literally dying, he says, and now I finally have the opportunity to fufill b'chol nafshecha, that I can do everything. So that's the higher aspirational side. So I want to show you that even in this aspirational expectation of having an effective relational connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even here, there is also space for uncertainty. Okay, if you even think about the Rabbi Akiva example, literally he was already giving up his life, right? There was space, and his Talmidim said to him, really, Rabbi? Is this really true? Like, they didn't even realize that Rabbi Akiva was as authentic and completely integrated at that critical moment. How could you even ask that question? Because it's such a grand goal. But there's a very basic premise here that I thought was important. And it goes back to also Hillel and Shammai. And the Gemara, the case that the Gemara brings of a convert who comes to request that they they're misguiding him. And so he goes to Shammai and he says, listen, I believe in Torah Shebichtav, I just don't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh. Can you do my conversion? And Shammai says, you're out of here. Forget about it. Right? Emunah requires, right, that you believe in Torah Shebaal Peh. And he goes to Hillel, and Hillel is misguiding. And so Rabbi Lam says, everyone reads this wrong. Everyone reads this as an expression of temperament, that Shammai had no patience and Hillel was compassionate. Rabbi Lam says, that's much more significant than that. Rabbi Lam says that what it means is that doubt is not denial. That if someone says to you, I believe in Torah, right, but I don't get everything, Hillel says, come. I have the confidence in the everything that if you're really learning, you'll get there. You're part of this conversation. Hillel's saying there is a place in this conversation for questions. It's totally fine. I have tremendous confidence both in Torah and in people's interest in learning more that it will happen. There's like a patience and a long view that Hillel represents that allows for methodological doubts. It's okay. We can have this conversation. You're not the first one. I'm not the first one. We can still do the mitzvot and learn more about the yeses and the noes while we wonder the whys.
And that's why he says at the end, go and learn.
So that's right. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. And the and it's consistent with Hillel. As opposed to making it about his temperament, you make it about his methodology, and Hillel is basically saying, let's continue this conversation. Okay, so the other Bekorot here really is Rashi on Hillel, saying that Rashi, that Hillel was not saying that Torah Baal Peh is not necessary as a portion of your Emunah. Rashi is simply saying, Hillel huftach she'achar yilmedu yismach alav. He recognized that the learning process requires the stages of questioning, and as he continues to learn, he's going to trust him, and he says to him, just like you trust me to teach you Torah Shebechtav, you clearly trust the rabbinic tradition, right? So I'll teach you the other stuff afterwards. It'll still continue, right? It doesn't have to all be there at the same time. And certainly when it comes to the psychological stages of development for teenagers, it's really important to remember patience, persistence, and the long view. It's not going to happen all at the same time. We need to be playing the game. We need to be learning the rules. We need to be coaching each other with a sense of confidence that this game has seen every weird version of play that you can imagine, and you can find your own curve, your own curveball. I'm using metaphors that I have no idea about because I don't know sports, but you will find your spark and be able to use that question not as a doubting point, but as a point of growth. An interesting point that I'll close with is that if you spend time, I spent a good deal of time learning Chovos HaLevavos Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Pakuda, who seems to have predated the Rambam and seems to have predated Buber and existentialism in saying that in all of his Shaar HaBitachon and in all of his Sha'arim about how it is that we build this relationship to mitzvos and this relationship to Hashem, the word emunah is not there. It's about bitachon, it's about ne'emanos, it's about consistency, it's about trustworthiness. It's not necessarily about proof. And in an age where, I say, instead of running away from the claim of show it to me, prove it to me, give me the quick answer, you know, in 150 characters or less, let's remember that emunah requires ongoing growth. And there are multiple layers. It's not binary. It's not all or nothing. And as long as the conversation is about a good question, the conversation needs to continue. You need to treasure those questions. You need to admit that they're just your own. They're so good. I had that question too. And I have. And then the other piece that I think is very important, and this is a little more practical, invite your adult friends and mentors and people that you respect to have that conversation publicly with your kids as well. It doesn't have to be a parent's single sole responsibility. By doing that alone, you take the questions out of the shadows, you validate them, you let your students and your children know that everybody who's a person of faith has these questions, and something that we love and live with. Learning to live with questions is far more valuable than learning to answer questions.